Between 2008 and 2011, Iceland suffered a banking collapse that was larger than any other in history when it was measured as a percentage of the country's GDP. In this video, I'll discuss some of the causes of this crisis. Let's begin by talking briefly about what Iceland was like before privatization in 2001. 100 years ago, most Icelandic houses were constructed from turf, and the country mostly consisted of farmers and fishermen. The poverty rate was high, and people spent most of their money on food. Two-thirds of the population lives in the capital city of Reykjavik, but unlike other Nordic countries, rural areas have a big presence in the parliament, meaning that issues that affect farming and fishing have always been given a lot of attention. Iceland became fully independent from Denmark in 1944, but the country's remoteness and small size has meant that it has received little international recognition. Andri Snær Magnusson, a popular Icelandic author, notes that, quote, "The post-colonial generation was always frustrated that anywhere they went in the world, nobody knew Iceland existed. Iceland, what's that? There was this kind of longing to be recognized, this longing to be a player." But as Ian Parker points out in a 2009 New Yorker article, quote, "The country remained a provincial, highly regulated place of cod and political cronyism." Until recent years, there's been very little support for anything like laissez-faire economics. The banking system was owned by the state, and government officials decided who got loans. One analyst notes that, quote, "There was no way to borrow to build a fence or buy a car or to obtain dollars to go abroad without kissing the rings of political functionaries. The all-encompassing role of the political class in the economy inevitably led to the soft corruption of patronage and influence peddling." The politically connected were able to get loans at low interest rates, and the government passed on the losses to the public through increased bank fees or taxes. Reform was difficult because politicians, both the ones in party and the opposition, tended to be well represented on bank boards. Newspapers, too, tended to toe the party line, which made it difficult for new and different ideas to circulate. Even as late as 1991, the state owned the banking system, the printing press, and the National Travel Agency. You were required to show evidence that you were traveling to a foreign country if you wanted to buy foreign currency. And the national TV broadcaster had just recently given up its longtime policy of not airing anything on Thursdays. Reform first began in Iceland in the 1960s, when the government severely cut subsidies to fishing. Amazingly, those subsidies had made up 40% of the government's federal budget. The currency, the krona, was also devalued as a way for Icelandic companies to better compete in international markets. There was a second wave of reforms in the 80s and 90s, when the government finally stopped regulating interest rates. This was important because those rates had typically not been allowed to rise higher than the inflation rate, which meant that real rates were actually negative. The country joined the European Economic Area in 1994 and abolished capital controls. Policymakers also made Iceland more business-friendly by reducing the corporate tax rate from 54% down to 18% and the income tax rate from 47% to 36%. The next step was the privatization of fish processing plants, the telephone company, but most importantly for our story, the banking system. There are many potential pitfalls in privatization, but one that's relevant here is the concern that privatization done poorly will merely convert state monopolies into private ones. That is, the state won't be controlling the enterprise in question any longer, but there also won't be private competition that would likely improve efficiency and service. From 2001 to 2003, Iceland relinquished its control over the banking system. And while the government didn't sell the banks to a single owner, and thus create a monopoly, they did auction them to a few wealthy businessmen at relatively low prices and in a non-transparent manner. This has led at least one critic to compare Iceland's privatization experience to the Russian case. By and large, the buyers of these banks had little experience in the financial sector, and they didn't inspire a lot of confidence. For instance, quote, "One major investor was a politician whose private sector experience consisted of running two small knitwear factories in the provinces in the 1970s for a few months. He became an instant billionaire. Another needed special legislative treatment to qualify because he had been in deep legal trouble in Russia. Previously, he had been awarded a conditional prison sentence in Iceland for fraud." The goal of privatization should be to move away from politically motivated loans to a world where banks loan money to the highest valued use. But these new business owners knew little about finance. John Danielson, an Icelandic economist at the London School of Economics, says of these bankers, quote, "They had no history, little experience. At the start, anything made a profit. None of the banks understood the riskiness of their strategy." Unfortunately, while the new bank owners had little experience in finance, their regulatory system in Iceland was also sorely lacking. The Financial Supervision Authority was the agency in charge of regulating the banks, but there was a co-option process that went on that undermined its power. The Icelandic banks regularly lured away the best, most experienced people from the agency with the promise of much higher salaries in the financial sector. Relatively unregulated, the banks went on a, quote, unprecedented borrowing and lending spree that increased the assets of the banking system from about 100% of national income in 2000 to an astonishing 900% in mid-2008. Bank officers were evaluated according to how many loans they made, not the quality of loans they made, and they responded exactly how you would expect to these kind of incentives. Inflation was rising in the 2000s, and the Icelandic Central Bank responded by raising interest rates from 5.3% in 2003 to over 14% in 2007. The high interest rates caused foreign investors to take note and money flowed into the country. People could borrow money where interest rates were low, say in Japan, invest it in Iceland at a higher rate, and make a profit from the interest rate differential. This is called the carry trade, and it was very popular in Iceland, so much so that the demand for the krona increased substantially. An appreciating krona allowed Icelanders to travel abroad and to import goods and services more cheaply. They weren't even that worried about rising inflation, because they were able to borrow money from countries with lower interest rates. They did so in droves, borrowing abroad to buy things like cars and houses. As long as the value of the krona was rising, there was no problem in paying off the foreign debt. However, as we'll see shortly, the krona would soon drop precipitously and make it difficult, if not impossible, for many Icelanders to pay back this debt. In 2006, Landsbanki, the oldest and second largest Icelandic bank, began offering foreigners the opportunity to open online bank accounts called iSave. iSave wasn't around for long before the crisis hit, but it still managed to sign up 300,000 people from the UK and 100,000 from the Netherlands. All of this new investment in Iceland created an economic and stock market boom, some would say a bubble. As we'll see in the next video, things collapsed quickly starting in 2008. There are many excellent analyses of Iceland. The information from this video comes from Þorvaldur Gylfason's Iceland After the Fall, a Milken Institute review paper from November 2009, from Ian Parker's Lost, Letter from Reykjavik, After Financial Disaster, Icelanders Reassess Their Identity, from the New Yorker in 2009, a chapter in a 2010 book called From Boom to Bust, The Iceland Story, and Jake Halpern's 2009 New York Times Magazine story called Iceland's Big Thaw.